Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Well, about 10 years ago, we got to take a look at an intriguing book called Searching for Virginia Dare, written by Chatham County's Marjorie Hudson, who subsequently has become an award-winning author and a wonderful and popular writing teacher, and more than anything else, someone who is in service to her fellow writers in many, many different ways. She's with us to tell us why there, after 10 years, why we're searching for Virginia Dare again. Marjorie, welcome.
Thank you, D.G. Thank you. Well, why are we still searching for her? Well, we haven't found her yet. That's part of why.
I was thinking about this, that she is North Carolina's most popular missing person.
Yep, I think so. And her story continues to be a mystery.
Tell us, for those who may just not be in total touch with the story of Virginia Dare, give us a brief introduction to her.
Yeah, she was part of the England's first colony in the New World, and was led by her grandfather, John White, who was a visual artist, a painter. He brought his daughter and 115 other colonists to Roanoke Island off the coast of North Carolina in 1587. And their plan was to start a colony. They were staying in a fort, and they were meant to go to Chesapeake Bay. But they got into an argument with their pilot, and so they ended up kind of marooned on Roanoke Island. Yeah, so his daughter, Eleanor, was about to give birth, and so she gave birth. He christened her daughter Virginia Dare, and she gave birth on August 18. She was christened on August 24, and shortly thereafter,
August 18th, 1587.
Yeah, okay. 426 years ago. Mm-hmm. So her grandfather then was convinced to go back to England for supplies and for help, because they were in a place that they really did not want to be. There were hostile Native people surrounding them. They had a few friends. The Native American Manteo and his people were had made an alliance with him. But they were in danger. And so one of the great mysteries is why did he leave? Why did he go back? And how was he not able to return for 3 years? What most people know is when he did return finally, it was Virginia Dare's third birthday, and he found on the palisade of the remaining fort the word Croatoan, and everyone gone. So that's
what we know.
That's the mystery that hangs. But there's so much more to it, and there's so much research, detail, archival material. Current research is still going on, and there have been some new findings in recent years that are really exciting. So I approach it as both history and a family story. The thing that captured me right off the bat was that here was a father, a daughter, and a granddaughter, and they're lost to each other. There's so much ambition in the story. People all thought they would get rich. They all thought they would find gold. They all were promised 500 acres apiece on the banks of the Chesapeake Bay, and they all ended up in the wrong place with tragic results, but we don't know what happened to them. I think that there may be descendants of survivors, and many, many others think that as well, because they did have some Native American friends, and because 100 years later, John Lawson came, a great English explorer, John Lawson came and found that there was a tribe of people on the Outer Banks who claimed descendancy, and who had gray eyes, which are never found among these people. And they took him. They said that their ancestors knew how to read, and they spoke some English. So there is some evidence of survival among Native American
people. Well, there's always skeptics who have arguments to show that these ideas about the descendants might not be correct? What are the skeptics' arguments against the Outer Banks Indians being descendants from the Virginia Dare colony?
Well, the people know that Powhatan up in Virginia claimed to have killed all of the English settlers who were in the area, and he knew about the colonists on Roanoke Island. They had since moved to other places, so it's very possible that they moved on to Croatoan, to the village of Manteo. There's also evidence that they moved to places where Powhatan didn't know where they were. So, you know, the big argument is that Powhatan claimed to have killed them all in a great war in the early 1600s.
Well, there are other claimed kinships and stories and legends about Virginia Dare and about the other colonies, the other colonists that you talk about and explore in your book.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that has emerged over the centuries is this extraordinary series of legends that have come up and that are not based on anything like fact that I can figure. But in 1903, Sally Southall Cotton published an epic poem, kind of an Iliad for the New America, which was a love story about Virginia Dare, who, in her view, had grown up among Native people and had fallen in love with a young warrior and then been kind of put a spell on and turned into a white doe by a jealous shaman in the tribe. And it's this whole fantastic tale. It sounds a lot like the Hiawatha story. It has that same rhythm flow on the shores of Gitche-Gumee, only it's on the shores of Albemarle Sound. And she would go around and perform this poem as a way during the years before the turn of the century to raise money to educate young women who she feared after the Civil War would not be able to marry because there was a dearth of young men in the South after the war. So she was an activist. She was she went to the World's Fair in Chicago and sort of beat the drum of Virginia Dare, and they rang the Columbia Bell on the day of Virginia Dare's birthday, and she felt sure that no one would ever forget her. And of course, we have kind of forgotten her, and I think that's one of the reasons that I'm drawn to this story is because it's so little known and little understood in its marvelous detail and its marvelous legend and the research and facts about the story are also really fascinating.
Well, separate the I'll tell you, my impression is that there are lots of legends and very few facts. But you say there's some facts that are important.
There's extraordinary amount of factual material. We have the primary sources that were compiled by D.B. Quinn in a two-volume set called The Roanoke Voyages, in which all of the logbooks of John White on his voyages are kept, the logs of Thomas Harriot, the science officer on the journey, the maps that were created, letters of the Spanish royal courts, which showed that they had spies in the area and they knew that the colony was there. So there's just a wealth, hundreds and hundreds of pages of primary sources. And one of the people doing research in this area is Fred Willard. Some contemporary research is being done to see if we can link the DNA of descendants of Native Americans in the area of the Outer Banks of North Carolina to the DNA of English people who might have descended from John White and his people. So it's a difficult thing to do. It hasn't been done yet. But one of the most interesting parts of the story is the fact of Native American presence in the area. Native Americans didn't just disappear here. They lingered on in various communities. In fact, there were five, maybe six reservations for Indians after various wars between English people and Native Americans here. And there was a great, there were great migrations among Native people. And among those people, there maybe have been descendants of the colony.
Well, we're visiting with Marjorie Hudson and talking about a revision to her, I will call it a classic book, Searching for Virginia Dare. And we're going to talk some more about Virginia Dare, whose birthday is August the 18th. And we're going to talk some more about the first edition of the book and then the added material. All that with Marjorie Hudson after this short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Marjorie Hudson's my guest. Many of you know Marjorie as the as a wonderful writing teacher, as someone who works with the writing community, whose wonderful book of short stories and short fiction, Accidental Birds of the Carolinas, got great attention from lots of other people other than me. And she's now gone back and republished her 10-year-old book, Searching for Virginia Dare, with some more reflection and more searching.
More searching.
Thanks for giving us this background about Virginia Dare. It raises all kinds of things. One of the exciting things that happened, I guess, last year was the publication about a map that John White had had made the map, and there was a secret patch on it which talked about or which maybe showed a possible planned location for the relocation of the colony. What did you find out about this?
Well, it's an extraordinary discovery, and I felt really abashed because I was in the same place that this scholar was, only I was looking at the drawings at the British Museum in the special collections room wearing those little white gloves that they have you wear. But this scholar took some time with the John White maps, and he did that thing that everyone should do when they're doing research. He asked the question that seemed like kind of a stupid question, but no one had asked it before in 425 years. And the question was, hey, here's a patch on the map. I wonder what's underneath. And scholars for all this time had had a theory. You know, it was common practice to patch a map, and it would usually be for reasons of covering up some kind of mistake, you know. In fact, when they went and put it on a light table in answer to answer his question, they discovered a clear marking for an English fort on the banks of the Chowan River, a fort not mentioned in any of the other written documentation about the colonists. And it was a fort, because it was on the map of that era, it was a fort for the colony. And next to
it was marked of an existing fort or a planned fort. What was?
Well, that's a really good question. And to answer that question, as just this year, this summer, National Geographic has funded the First Colony Foundation to do some excavation and some special. Gosh, I can never get the names of them right. It's a magnetometry, ground-penetrating radar, side-scan radar, as well as surface surveys. Mm. So they're going to this location, which is on the Chowan River, and they're, unfortunately, that area has just recently been dug up, moved around, smoothed over, and turned into a golf course. So these guys are so smart that I'm sure they'll find a way to discover what's under the surface and see if there actually was a fort there. And they'll be able to date the fort, and they'll be able to come up with artifacts and any kind of iron objects that were used in the fort. And it could be, you know, it could be that we found the holy grail of the Virginia Dare story.
Well, if there is evidence of a settlement there from that time period, then we would think it would be possible that the colony or the group of colonists moved from Roanoke Island to this location.
That's right.
That still doesn't solve any mystery, does it?
Well, you know, how they moved and when they moved and who survived and all that sort of thing. We don't know the answer to that, but really tantalizing things have happened. For example, in an area near there in near the Alligator River in the 1960s, I think, coffins were found that had special markings on them. And they were dug up when people were building canals and roads there, and bones fell out of the coffins and were not rescued and were not studied and have not been found again. So that's the coffins were made out of cypress dugout canoes, and they were formed, which is not the way Native people bury their people, and they had special Christian markings carved into them. So you never know what you're going to find, and there's way more that people can learn than we think. There's also things like the Virginia Dare Stones or the Eleanor Dare Stones, 48 rocks carved with messages as if from Eleanor to her father, telling him who died, where they died, and that she is traveling with an Indian chief. The stones were found in a line all the way from the Chowan River area to northern Georgia. And the Smithsonian planned to study the stones, and they never did, because right around the time they made that decision, it was December 7, 1941, and the U.S. government had other obligations. Mm-hmm. So there's layers and layers of research.
Well, now, sorting out the legends from the facts, and then also sorting out what might have been somebody trying to pull a trick. Mm. That these stones were perhaps laid by somebody who wanted people to think that. I mean, do you sort these out in your research? You just take everything that happened and accept it as beautiful, or you have a little bone of skepticism?
Oh, I have a skeptical mind. Yes, and you know how I feel about those stones in particular is that think of it. Yeah, these stones were scattered along the Chattahoochee River banks and all up and down and found in various places. If it was a hoax, what an extraordinary thing that is. You know, I'd like to know. And I'd like to know the story. I'd like to know who had something to gain from it. And I'd like to have a symposium about, you know, archaeological hoaxes. Mm-hmm. I tend to believe that the first stone might have been, it's possible that it was kind of the real thing. The later stones that were found were completely different in their method of carving. And they also were not, they were enormous stones. They were like 3 or 4 feet long. They were not transportable. And somehow they all ended up at Brunel College, now university, in the in a storage shed covered with oak leaves and spiders. So, you know, my tendency is to, let's look at them.
Well, why haven't they? I mean, people are curious about this story. Why haven't they either shot this story down or said we need to do some more research? It doesn't make a lot of sense. It's just locked in a barn somewhere.
Yeah, you're right. Well, there is a scholar at UNC Wilmington. His name escapes me right now, who has researched it further and concluded, as I did, that the first stone might be for real. But I think, you know, colleges and universities, they're not sure they want to ally themselves with something that might be a hoax. But I think it's interesting, and I hope that someday they'll take a more measured approach and take a look at it and see how interesting it is that someone might have thought it was a good idea to spend all that much time creating a story that then could have turned into a blockbuster Hollywood film. And there were people who had aspirations in that direction.
Mm. We're visiting with Marjorie Hudson. We're talking about Searching for Virginia Dare, first published 10 years ago, now in a revised edition with additional material. And Marjorie's going to tell us more about the book after this short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Marjorie Hudson is my guest. Many of you know Marjorie Hudson, who lives down in Chatham County and is the author of the wonderful book of stories, Accidental Words of the Carolinas. But she's taken us back in time, 10 years ago, to the publication of Searching for Virginia Dare, which was your big introduction.
Yeah. And it was really kind of a love letter to North Carolina. I think when I started researching that book, that's when I became a North Carolinian. I was not born here. I didn't grow up with the story, but I had learned of it in my editorial work. I had taken on a job editing an eighth grade North Carolina history book. And all of the information about, you know, the discovery of the potato and Sir Walter Raleigh and tobacco and Manteo and Juan Cheese and the court of Queen Elizabeth, all were pretty fresh to me, and it was intriguing. It kind of stayed in the back of my mind. And when I got the invitation to write about women's history in North Carolina, it came from Emily Herring Wilson, who had just published an encyclopedia of women's history in North Carolina, a venerable scholar who's continues to write about women in North Carolina. And she invited me to write a short essay about any topic I chose. And I picked Virginia Dare because so little was known about it to me. I didn't realize that hardly anybody else knew much about it. And so the first thing I did when I was researching this is, well, okay, I've got to stack up some books. I've got to go talk to scholars. I had a journalism background, and I kind of knew where to go. I have to look at original sources, primary sources. But then I called museums, and one of the museums was in the eastern part of the state. And I just sort of naively called up and said, you know, I'm interested in women's history in North Carolina, and especially I wonder if you have any information about whatever became of Virginia Dare. And there was a pause on the line, and the voice came back and said, good luck. And that was kind of that. That was kind of my first signal that I was in strange territory and that I was going to have to explore more deeply. And because I like a challenge, I ended up researching and getting more deeply into the story. Nobody had ever really talked about it much as a family story, except for a little bit in the Lost Colony play by Paul Green. And I really saw that in there. It was a time in my life when the generations were turning in my family. I had two grandmothers, my husband's grandmother and my grandmother, both would have turned 100 if they had lived, and they almost made it to 100. And it set me wondering on what happened 100 years ago or 200 years ago. And as I began to study North Carolina history, my family started telling me things that I didn't know. For example, my people are from North Carolina. There's an ancestor in 1851 in Lincoln County who went west to Illinois in a Conestoga wagon. And there's an ancestor, and we all are a bunch of Yankees, and there's an ancestor who was a hero in Pickett's Charge on the North Carolina side. So I started—
Brought you back into the fold, that you, as a stranger, but as a member of the family.
That's right. And I'm married a North Carolina boy, and I love being part of that family. It's a real different— it was a real different world for me, but I have, my husband calls me a born-again North Carolinian, or an honorary Southerner, depending on his mood. And I'm originally from the Midwest, where we have potluck suppers and church dinners and neighbors in small towns. And I identify with the small town community where I live from that personal history.
Well, no connection between Chatham County community and Virginia Dare. We don't have any descendants down there, do we?
Not that I know of, but everywhere I go, somebody comes up to me and says, you know, my aunt was named for Virginia Dare, so you never know. And the other thing is, There is a race of white deer in Chatham County, which is part of this marvelous story.
What is this? What is the white deer story?
The white doe is Sally Southall Cotton's story about Virginia Dare, the native, you know, and her Native American love triangle. And part of the story is someone turns Virginia Dare, the young maiden, the young virginal maiden, into a white doe, and she can only be transformed back into a maiden by a silver arrow. Two arrows are shot, and they cross, and she turns into a maiden, and then dies a terrible, you know, bloody death. And from her blood, the scuppernong vine rises as a symbol of, you know, love.
All this she made. All this she made this all up.
Well, you know, she. It's so intriguing. The name of her book is, the name of her epic poem is The White Doe, an Indian Legend. Mm-hmm. So she claims it's a legend that's heard among hunters and Native people. But by the time she wrote it, there were scarce, the Native, contact with Native people would have been rare indeed, except among the Lumbee Nation, which, as we know, survived along the banks of the Lumber River down near in Robeson County. So the white doe, it's interesting, it does not pop out on the Outer Banks. Nobody ever sees them out there, but they see them where I live, and I have my neighbor years ago when I was researching this was tracking a white doe that was eventually shot and stuffed and put in the local gas station mart down by Jordan Lake. And I think it had blue eyes in the taxidermy version. And people would come up and kind of pet it for good luck.
Well, what is – here's my theory, that the legend of Virginia Dare – is that Paul Green's play solidified the relationship between Virginia Dare as a North Carolina figure and the North Carolina school children who came to see the Lost Colony. But against that theory is that the Dare County was named Dare County long before Paul Green put the play together, and that there's this love affair or this... And it's the only, I think it's the only county in North Carolina named for a woman. I believe this. I believe that's right.
Yeah.
And so, for some reason, we think she's special, even though, as you found out, it's hard to find out any real facts about her.
Sure.
Other than she was born.
Well, what we know is that she was born, and she was baptized a week later, and that. Some of the people who remained in the colony survived for 3 years, long enough to, you know, to leave behind a message carved on a palisade, and that she may have survived. That's what we know, and we really don't. Mm-hmm. We will probably never know if she survived unless someone comes up with a descendant in England of. Either Ananias, her father, or John White, her grandfather. Her grandfather, John White, had other children, so there may be a DNA stream. Ananias, I think, may have had another child, so there may be a DNA stream from.
So,
him.
Well, now you're thinking and teasing us a little bit,
yes.
About this, and is there an actual search underway in England for a relatives of Virginia Dare?
Well, you know, on the History Channel, they went and tried to dig somebody up and match it up, but they didn't get too far with that. There are people who are doing some serious DNA studies. I don't know where that stands mm-hmm. now, but they have. But the first task is to find documentation of people who are related to. The people who we know were ancestors of Virginia Dare. So that's been difficult. And it's fascinating. Apparently, Ananias is an unusual name in those days in England. But John White is a pretty common name. And in those days, people had children and they might name six of them John. There'd be John the Elder, John the Middle, and John the John the Junior, because so many of them died before they came of age. So it's a very difficult thing to do. But people who are better researchers than I are working on it.
Wow.
So.
Well, you're a pretty good researcher, as evidenced by the first edition of Searching for Virginia There and now the revised edition. We're visiting with Marjorie Hudson. She and I will be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Marjorie Hudson. We're talking about the revised edition, the newly revised edition of Searching for Virginia Dare, a very popular book about a very popular North Carolinian, Virginia Dare. Hard to explain why. But you, Marjorie, you're going to read us a little bit of your book.
Yeah. I just want to say that the book contains an odd mix of history, research, interview, road trip, memoir, and fiction. And it's because the story seized me so personally, and it brought to mind all kinds of personal life adventures and my own travels and my own losses. Because at that time, I just completely identified with story and became kind of obsessed with it. I also, at that time, was studying fiction writing in the MFA program at Warren Wilson College. And so in one room of my house, I was writing about Virginia Dare in fact form and nonfiction form. In the other room of my house, I took the Shelby Foote program, write different books in different rooms of your house to keep them straight. The other room, I was writing my fiction thesis for my MFA, and I think some of it leaked over. I began to really see that we don't know certain things about what exactly happened, but we can certainly imagine them. So this is what I imagined happened on the day Virginia Dare was born, August 18, 1587. 5:30 a.m., the hour is utterly pink and soft and silent, except for the hiss of the tide against the banks of the island and the glassy cries of seabirds. The color blooms. It blooms like a kiss. It blooms like one of these strange curved shells with a rainbow sheen. It blooms across the sky like the rush of fragrant air from the ripening muscadine. It blooms and opens like the mouth of a baby sucking for breath and then crying its pure, unbaptized heathen life.
Mm. Well, that's beautiful writing. Yeah, that.
Thank you.
It is something that you can imagine. Somebody was thinking. Whose voice were you writing?
I think it's sort of an omniscient voice, but maybe a little bit of the consciousness of Eleanor Dare.
This is a mama. A little bit of the mama.
Of
the mama Virginia Dare.
Yeah.
We're talking about Virginia Dare and. We're doing it on the occasion of the publication of the revised edition. So what's new?
What's new? Well, I was not done with Virginia Dare in 2002 when the book came out, and I continued to remain obsessed. I did some traveling. I went to Rome, and I went to London. In London, I got to see the original John White paintings. I got to handle them and look at them more closely, and I got very fascinated with some of his depictions of the swallowtail butterflies and the sea turtles and the animals that he discovered in the New World. And I also got to travel to Rome. And one of the things that's just been fascinating is to explore the life of Louisa Lander, who was a sculptor, a young woman sculptor from Salem, Massachusetts, who made a Virginia Dare statue while being an artist in Rome. It was carved in Carrara marble in one of the stone carving studios there, and she had all kinds of compatriot artists she hung out with, American expats. And one of the artists she hung out with was Nathaniel Hawthorne, who was living in Rome with his family. Yeah, what a surprise. 1850s, just after the big success of the well, now I'm going to say the scarlet thread. Now that's wrong. The scarlet letter. Doris Betts's book is also just out. So the scarlet letter, and, you know, it was interesting. It was about a woman who commits adultery. And during the time that he was there, Louisa Lander had him sit for a sculpture. So while he was sitting, he was studying her for his next novel. And his next novel was The Marble Faun, which is about the adventures of a woman artist in Rome going from location to different museums. And if you read that book, which I did while I was in Rome, I went from museum to gallery to museum, scouting all of the things that his expat artists must have seen in his
but now,
novel.
The, just a loose connection, we got Nathaniel Hawthorne
yes.
being in the same room as somebody who's sculpturing Virginia Dare.
That's right.
But so what?
What does that have to do with Virginia Dare? Well, the Virginia Dare statue, you know, I think about it this way. Hawthorne was so interested in Americana, and so was this intrepid young woman sculptor, and she was interested in Evangeline. She was interested in Virginia Dare. She had been to the British Museum like me and had looked at the paintings and maps and journals and just did this extraordinary thing. It just simply was not done at that time. And so the fact that she inspired in her, Hawthorne may have seen the Virginia Dare statue. It was in her studio during that time. But that he was inspired by her, and she was in turn inspired by Virginia Dare, really speaks to me.
Mm-hmm. Whatever happened to the statue?
Oh, gosh, what a story. The statue was shipped to America, but it was shipwrecked off the coast of Spain. It was rescued. It was in a fire in a gallery in New York. It was sold and then reverted when the buyer did not pay. So the artist, Louisa Lander, ended up living in Washington, D.C. with the Virginia Dare statue in her living room. And she'd gotten a little dotty by this time, I think, and she would say good morning to it every morning. And that's where the lives of Louisa Lander and Sally Southall Cotton converged. Sally went to see her one day to get her to donate the statue to the state of North Carolina. And to do that, Sally Southall Cotton stood up in her living room and performed her epic poem. And I think she wore kind of fringed outfit for this. She was kind of the Virginia Dare figure. And Louisa Lander was convinced, and she did donate it to North Carolina. It had many adventures in North Carolina. I won't go into them here, but they're documented in the book. And it ended up in the Elizabethan Gardens, where it sits now, in a little alcove amongst the live oak trees in a place very near where Virginia Dare must have played as a child.
Wow. Well, Marjorie Hudson, I could talk about Virginia Dare. It's really fun about our favorite, North Carolina's favorite missing person. But what about you? What now? You're still basking in the success of Accidental Birds, and you must be enjoying revisiting of Virginia Dare. So, are you through now for a while?
Well, no, I'm traveling around a little bit, talking to people at independent bookstores about Virginia Dare. But what I'm doing most of the time is teaching creative writing workshops, and I'm also finishing up a novel draft, which I've been working on.
This will be your first novel.
First novel, yeah. And it continues the stories of some of the characters in Accidental Birds of the Carolinas.
Well, I can't wait.
Thank you.
Accidental Birds is a great series of stories that anybody who lives around here will identify with. And then, of course, Virginia Dare. So good luck. Get that book out quick. We'll be waiting for it.
Thank you, DG.
We've been talking to Marjorie Hudson about the revised edition of her classic book, Searching for Virginia Dare. Thanks for listening. I'll be back here before you know it.